You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison.
Hello, this is Julie Candler with the BBC News. President Biden has said the US will begin sending new military assistance to Ukraine within hours after he signed a long-awaited bill passed by Congress. The package is worth $61 billion. It also includes billions in additional aid for Israel and Taiwan, Will Grant reports.
President Biden's core message after signing the foreign aid bill was that sending billions of dollars in military aid to Ukraine made the United States itself safer too. It's an investment in our own security, he said, because when our allies are stronger, we are stronger. Mr. Biden acknowledged that the legislation had taken what he called a difficult path to his desk, a reference to the bitter divisions, particularly within the Republican Party, over the continued funding and arming of Ukraine. However, when it most matters, he said, the US had risen to the moment.
Israeli officials have confirmed that they're moving ahead with plans for a military assault on Rafah in southern Gaza, where they say several Hamas battalions remain. There have been repeated international appeals, including from the United States, for Israel not to undertake a full-scale attack. More than 1 million Palestinians are sheltering in the city. Unconfirmed reports say Israeli and Egyptian officials have met to coordinate the implications of a large offensive. A popular rapper in Iran has been sentenced to death for supporting anti-government protests that erupted across the country 18 months ago. Tumaj Salehi was arrested in October 2022. Here's Baran Abbasi from BBC Persian.
The death penalty against Tumaj Salehi was issued for corruption on earth, a vaguely worded charge that is often used against critics of the regime. The 33-year-old was a prominent supporter of the wave of mass protests that broke out after the death of a young woman, Mahsa Amini, in custody. Mr. Salehi was first sentenced to death 2 years ago, but a higher court rejected the sentence and sent the case back for review. Now facing a death sentence once again, he has 20 days to appeal. His lawyer says he definitely plans to do so.
TikTok is suspending the rewards program on its Light app while it addresses concerns it could be addictive, especially for children. Chris Valance reports.
The rewards program in the TikTok Light app, which recently rolled out in France and Spain, allows users to earn a few pennies a day in the form of vouchers, gift tokens, or tips to other TikTokers in return for watching videos. But the European Union said it would suspend the app if TikTok failed to convince it was safe. Now, a day before threatened action, TikTok has voluntarily suspended the rewards program while it addresses the EU's concerns. The firm has always denied it was addictive and says it's not available to under-18s and has daily limits on video watch tasks.
BBC News. The World Health Organization says global immunization efforts have saved at least 154 million lives in the last half century. In a report published by The Lancet, the WHO said vaccination had been the biggest single contributor to the prevention of deadly infections since the 1970s. The organization said the measles vaccine had saved the most lives. Government troops in Myanmar are reported to have re-entered an important border town that was taken by rebel forces earlier this month. An armed ethnic group has withdrawn from at least some parts of Miawadi after a counter-offensive by the army. Its loss was a major victory for the loose alliance of ethnic groups and pro-democracy forces that oppose the Burmese military. At least 10 people have died as a result of heavy flooding in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Emergency workers have been rescuing people and some residents have sought safety on the roofs of their partially submerged homes. The Norwegian Afghanistan Committee says it has co-hosted the first talks between the Taliban, the UN and other agencies of the impact of climate change. University staff, diplomats and other officials were at the discussions. Afghanistan ranks as one of the countries least prepared to face the effects of climate change. A painting by the Austrian artist Gustav Klimt that was believed lost for the past 100 years has been sold at auction for more than $30 million. The unfinished work, Portrait of Fraulein Lisa, went under the hammer in Vienna.
30 millions, your 122, 30 millionen zum dritten. Gratulation. Danke vielmals.
The painting was commissioned by a family of wealthy Jewish industrialists in 1917, a year before Klimt's death. It was left unsigned in the artist's studio when he died and was given to the family. BBC News.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for 2 open participating member seats and 1 open listener sponsor seat to serve 3-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2027. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Wednesday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 30th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 30th. More information and board applications are available at WORTFM.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground.
And good afternoon, and welcome to WORT's Noontime Community Conversation, a public affair. I'm Bert Zipper, your substitute host today. And I am profoundly honored and excited to have today's guest with us. Today we have Brad Wolf here with us on WORT. He is a retired lawyer, a former prosecutor, and a full-time peace activist. He's also written an incredibly important book on Phil Berrigan and the writings of on peace and nonviolence by Phil Berrigan called A Ministry of Risk. Brad is also a co-founder of Peace Action Network of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and he coordinates the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal. And today we're going to talk about the writings of Phil Berrigan. Brad Wolf, welcome to WORT.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me.
Yesterday we had a great conversation, and here we go today to continue that. Listeners, please feel free to call in at any time at 608-256-2001, or you can email us online at WORTFM.org and join in the conversation. Brad, it seems like we're at a really important moment with the raging war in Gaza, the U.S.-Israeli war there, that Phil would have a lot to say on a day like today.
I believe he would. The times are dark, they're grim right now, but I think we have to have hope. And that's why this book is so important, because I think it does instill hope in people. It certainly did in me when I was researching and compiling it for publication. But it's books like these that allow us to see what others have done in the past when they've faced difficult and dark times. And Phil was battling segregation and racism in the 50s, and then the Vietnam War in the 60s. And then the Cold War and the scourge of nuclear weapons. And he did not give up. And he was always trying to place himself on the side of victims, push back the darkness with the truth, with life. And I think we can take a lesson from that today. So that's why I'm excited about the book coming out. And I'm hoping it reaches new demographics, new generations, and everybody can take spirit and hope from the book.
That's a great way of framing it. Thank you, Brad. You know, for those of us who were around in the 60s, and you're just a little bit younger than I, but we're both in our 60s, not the 1960s. But in the 1960s, the Berrigan brothers, Dan and Phil was the older brother, they were inspiring Catholic priests who spoke out and took action against social evils, especially the U.S. war in Southeast Asia. And they were just part and parcel of the social fabric of the United States. They were part of the Catonsville 9, the Harrisburg 7, the Baltimore 4. Talk about that time. Why are the Berrigans important? Why is Phil Berrigan important?
Phil Berrigan is important for the fact that as a Catholic priest, at that time in the 1950s and 1960s, when he was emerging as a public figure, Catholic priests were the embodiment of middle-class conservatism in America. And so it's one thing for young people, for college students or hippies from the 1960s to be protesting, but for a middle-aged Catholic priest to be doing that and to be going to prison for protesting in nonviolent acts of resistance, that was different, and that gained notoriety and attention. And Phil knew that his position as a Catholic priest would do that. So he wanted to stimulate discussion around the American dinner table each night about racism and about war. And he knew if he put his body on the line that it would have that consequence. So I think it's interesting to trace the evolution of Phil Berrigan. He's a World War II veteran, sees a lot of horrible things in Europe when he fights in World War II. He comes home and he has to, as he writes, look into the mirror of his own violence. And he has to reconcile what he did and what he saw with his faith. And he eventually decides to join the Catholic Josephite Order of Priests, an order dedicated to serving African Americans. And he chose that specifically because of the racism he saw during basic training when he was down south. And he was appalled by that. And so he became a Catholic priest. He became a Josephite priest. And in the 1950s, he begins getting very involved in civil rights activism. And then in the 60s, anti-war activism, because he sees this link between militarism and racism. And so he continues that throughout the rest of his life until he passes in 2002.
Now, he, as a priest, he was committed to taking action, and it kind of must have annoyed the superiors because he did quite a tour of cities as a Catholic priest. Talk about that.
He did indeed. You know, the Catholic Church, as most people can understand, is one where priests are to conform and obey orders. And Phil did his best to obey the orders of what he understood to be the faith of Christ. And so he was walking the walk. And so when he was speaking out for the poor and he was standing up to try to organize for better housing for the African Americans, he thought that he was living out his faith and following the church in the best way possible. But the church in the 1950s did not appreciate this. So they continued to move Phil around from one diocese to another to try to silence him. And he went from Baltimore to New Orleans to New York City to Newburgh, New York to Washington, D.C., and each time was an effort to keep him quiet. But of course, every time he went there, he would simply organize again, speak out, write. And he became to be pretty well known in anti-war circles, such that he was able to publish his first book in 1965 called No More Strangers. And so while the church was not very appreciative of his work, there was another segment of American society that was very appreciative of his work.
Now, you have a theme that several times you come back to, a 1958, I believe, retreat for youth, and yes. Phil's message to the youth.
That was a fascinating document to find. When I was researching this, I went to the archives at Cornell University and DePaul University, which is where the Berrigan papers are housed. And there are literally hundreds of cartons of documents there from the Berrigans. Their speeches, their letters, their journals, everything you can imagine. And so as I'm going through, I'm trying to select what I think are the best of Phil's writings and also writings that tell the story of Phil's life, sort of an evolution from his beginning to an end. So we basically have a book here that is an autobiography told by Phil. And one of the first writings I include in the book is this speech he's given. It's at Father Higgins' youth retreat, where he is a young priest and he's talking to adolescents and he's trying to engage them. And, you know, he was a brash, young, good-looking guy, and I think he probably would have connected with those folks, but he was asking them a very difficult question and in trying to get their attention. And it basically came down to, what's it going to be with you? Are you going to sit on the fence, burning the candle at both ends, taking it easy? Or are you going to live up to God's grace and do something with yourself? And I kind of thought, boy, at that moment in Phil's life, he was probably asking himself that same question. and was not yet sure of exactly what direction that was going to take. But within a few years, it becomes clear what direction that took for Phil.
We are talking with Brad Wolfe, who just wrote and edited a collection of Philip Berrigan's writings called A Ministry of Risk, Writings on Peace and Nonviolence. And we invite you to call in and join the conversation at 608-256-2001. So Phil Berrigan, 1962, October, the Cuban Missile Crisis. Talk about the importance of that.
Yeah, Phil was, he had been moved to New Orleans at that time, and he was teaching in a school down in New Orleans when the Cuban Missile Crisis occurred. And it struck him with really a sobering blow, the idea that a handful of men could hold the fate of the world in their hands was appalling to him. And the fact that they were engaged in this game, as he put it, of nuclear chicken, playing chicken with each other with the fate of the world, was really offensive to him. And so what he also noticed in New Orleans, because he was working in the African-American community at that time, was that New Orleans was in the zone that would be struck first by the first wave of missiles if there was a war. And all the middle class and upper middle class white people left the area. And the folks they left behind were the African-Americans and the poor. And so Phil right away saw this link between racism, militarism, poverty, right? We spend trillions of dollars on missiles, and we have an economic system favoring those who already have money, leaving behind those who don't. And so they get to flee to safety while the poor and the minorities are left behind. So that was really an eye-opening episode for Phil. So from that point on, he started to look into racism, militarism, and materialism much heavier.
Sort of like a nuclear Hurricane Katrina, in a sense.
Exactly. Exactly. That's a good way to put it. Yeah, that's a very good way to put it. Yes.
Wow. So now, the mid-60s, the U.S. commitment in Vietnam, the troops being sent over there, young men being drafted, and Phil takes action. Talk about those first draft file actions.
He does. And you know, Phil tried to work within the confines of public discourse. He wrote, he spoke out about it. He was able to meet with officials in the Kennedy and Johnson administration to express his concerns about Vietnam, but to no avail. The policy continued, the escalation went on, the draft began, and more people began to die. And so he realized he was going to have to do something that was going to get the attention of the American public. And so he started risking arrest outside certain military bases, and that wasn't sufficient because it wasn't generating the kind of publicity. So he conceived of this idea along with three others, where in 1967, they would go into one of the Selective Service offices in Baltimore, Maryland. And those offices that's where the draft files were held. And these draft files were hard copy files. They were not on computer, they were compiled for young men between the ages of 18 and 26. And this is what sent them off to war, to either be killed or to kill Vietnamese. And so they conceived of this idea that they were going to go in and do a draft, quote, raid. They would take the files out and they would pour blood on the files. And the blood was meant to be symbolic, you know, symbolic of the spilt blood of Christ, but also the spilt blood of all the Vietnamese and Americans who were dying. So they did this. They notified the press in advance because they wanted maximum publicity. They went in, they took the files out, they poured blood. And part of this blood was their own blood that they had withdrawn because they wanted to be sure that was part of the symbolism. And they poured the blood on it and they came outside and waited for arrest, which they were quickly arrested at that point. And Phil was sentenced, had a trial, and sentenced to 6 years in prison for that one act. So that was a pretty dicey act, a pretty bold act. It garnered a fair amount of national attention, but still not enough for Phil. And so from the time of October 67, when he commits that act, until he is supposed to go to prison, he realizes he has to organize another act, a bigger act, something that's really going to shock people, really get them to start talking about this. So he quickly organizes a similar draft action in Catonsville, Maryland, in May of 68. And then he doubles the number of people involved. It goes from four, now it's at eight. They're all Catholic. They go in And they use homemade napalm to remove about 400 draft files and pour it on the files outside to burn them. And this has the effect that Phil's after. This makes national and international news. And it also stimulates lots of other draft raids by lots of other people. Because what they didn't know, and this is such a fascinating part, what Phil and his colleagues did not know was that there were no copies kept of these draft records. So when they destroyed them, they literally were saving young men from being sent to kill or be killed in Vietnam. And so all these other groups began to take up draft raids at different Selective Service offices all across the country. And I researched this, and there were hundreds of draft raids, and there were hundreds of thousands of files that were destroyed. So you can think of the lives saved as a result of that. And when I've talked to Phil's children, like to Frida, she said throughout her life, people have come up to her and said, my file was one of the files destroyed. And were it not for that, I would have been sent to Vietnam and possibly died.
Wow.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought in depth about draft files, but in reading your book, I believe these are Phil's words, that draft files were villainous, morally and spiritually illicit human hunting licenses for the men drafted and for the men, women, and children those draftees would kill. So that action was deeply profound, deeply powerful.
It was. And Phil was of the belief that certain property is so evil, so villainous, that it doesn't deserve to exist at all. And it could be draft files, and it could be nuclear weapons, as he took up later. Because some people believe that the destruction of property is pushing the boundaries of nonviolent resistance.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Phil went through a long period of discernment before he took this action up. And he talked to his brother Dan for a long period about that before he convinced Dan to do it. They didn't do this lightly, but they thought it was necessary given the consequences.
I'm switching Berrigan brothers here. Now, Phil writes a great statement, we believe, about the Catonsville action. But you weren't able to find that. But what we do remember of that action, many of us, were those poetic words of Dan Berrigan. Can you talk about Dan's quote?
Yeah, Dan's, he joined Phil for the Catonsville action. He was not a part of the Baltimore action, but he joined for the Catonsville action. And it took some convincing on the part of Phil to get Dan to do that. And so when it came time to issue a statement about that, Phil allegedly has drafted a statement, which I was not able to find, and others who have researched it have not been able to find. But Dan's statement is now a classic in resistance literature. And he writes, "Our apologies, dear friends, for burning paper instead of children. We had no choice. We could not do other." And it goes on for quite a way, several pages. And it is one of the most beautiful and poetic statements in resistance literature. And Dan, of course, is a gifted poet. He was an award-winning poet and a wonderful, wonderful writer. And so that statement always gives me chills when I read it. I actually keep it on my iPhone in my notes section just to bring up, you know, randomly when I'm waiting somewhere for something, because it's just so wonderfully written, so powerful, and it sums up the idea of nonviolent resistance.
Absolutely. We are talking with Brad Wolf, who wrote a collection of Philip Berrigan's writings called A Ministry of Risk. Writings on peace and nonviolence. So we're talking about Phil Berrigan today, and you can join the conversation, 608-256-2001, here at WORT. You quote Phil at one point that religion is the interior of politics, politics the exterior of religion, with an interdependence at once reinforcing. A truly political person is one who loves the victim sufficiently to resist their victimizers, to resist the power mongers of the state. Talk about that.
Yeah, that's a powerful statement. And, Phil was not political in the sense that he felt any political party was going to resolve the issues. He was not going to vote or anything like that. But he was political in the sense that he had to be in the center of political activity in the world, because that political activity was determining the fate of innocents around the globe. So they are the victims. And again, he was willing to place his body, his reputation on the line for the victims. And the title, A Ministry of Risk, comes from a homily that Phil gave in 1974, where he was speaking to a young priest, and he was trying to convey to that young priest the risk that was necessary to be a truly effective priest. And he talks about this idea of victimization. And it was interesting, the first day in the archives at Cornell, I found this speech, and I saw that, and I thought, that's the title, A Ministry of Risk.
That's great.
Is so perfect. Yeah. But if I could, I'd just read this, because it kind of goes to your question. Phil writes, "A ministry of risk goes unerringly to the side of the victims, to those threatened or destroyed by greed, prejudice, and war. From the side of those victims, it teaches two simple, indispensable lessons. Number one, that we all belong in the ditch or in the breach with the victims. And number two, that until we go to the ditch or into the breach, victimizing will not cease."
Very powerful words. Thank you, Brad.
Yeah,
thank
it
you.
Is. Yeah, thank you.
Let's go into a few of these essays. You've done a tremendous amount of work over many years going through countless files and letters and writings. You were citing yesterday a few of these, and I love the titles, which I know are yours, taking the words out, but Truth Makes Its Own Room. And where Eldridge Cleaver's Soul on Ice has impacted Father Phil Berrigan. Can you talk about that one, please?
I was able to read Phil's prison journals, and that was always interesting because these were handwritten journals, and they were etched out on paper, any kind of paper he could find. And he confessed to being in the doldrums while in prison, because it's easy to see Phil as this big, bold, brash kind of guy who never, you know, falters, but he admits to being in the doldrums while in prison, and he says what brought him out of the doldrums is reading Eldridge Cleaver's Soul on Ice. And Eldridge Cleaver, of course, was a Black Panther, and it's an interesting book for Phil to pick, because it's not that Eldridge Cleaver was nonviolent, he certainly wasn't. But what Phil found in that book was a man liberated by his suffering. And Phil was able to connect with this idea of prison being a sense of suffering, and you find liberation through prison, through suffering, and through relating to other people in prison. And Phil was very good at relating to other inmates. You know, you'd think a Catholic priest, how would they fare in prison? Who knows? But Phil fared very well. He got along well with them. Of course, he was in Lewisbury with Jimmy Hoffa at one point in the 70s, which
really
is kind of funny. Yes. Jimmy offered him protection, and Phil said, no, that's okay. I can handle myself. That's fine. You know? So the Soul on Ice book and that Truth Makes Its Own Room, I find to be a very interesting essay, because it shows the human side of Phil.
And talk about Christianity and Revolution Are Synonymous.
Yeah, that's an excellent essay. And you know, he writes that, you know, I'll read this last paragraph
Thank
from
you.
That.
Thank you.
And he says, Dan, and he's referring to his brother, Daniel Berrigan, Dan and I went to prison because we believe that Christianity and revolution are synonymous. Jesus Christ was a nonviolent revolutionary. Therefore, Christians have a duty to subvert society in order to create a world where justice prevails, particularly for the poor, who must be treated with fairness and love. So this idea of Christianity and revolution being synonymous, that is a revolutionary idea, certainly for me as a Catholic, right? I was born and raised Catholic, and nobody ever told me that Christianity and revolution were synonymous, just the opposite. And the idea that a Christian must subvert society is truly a radical thought. And that's what I learned as I read all of Phil's work. I came away with, he was truly a revolutionary, a nonviolent revolutionary, but he recognized that this system in America, this American way of life, could not be reformed. It was going to have to be replaced with something else, which meant nonviolent revolution and eventually liberation. And it was the duty of a Christian to undertake that task. And if you were really going to follow the works of Christ, if you were really going to walk the walk, then you were going to have to expose yourself to derision and humiliation, to damage to reputation, bankruptcy, and possibly prison. Even death, he said. You know, he was looking at life imprisonment in 1971 when J. Edgar Hoover was after him. And, you know, I think that was something he was willing to undertake.
You have given us a real gift here, Brad, with this collection of writings. And I personally highly recommend The Ministry of Risk, Writings on Peace and Nonviolence, the writings of Philip Berrigan. We're talking to Brad Wolf today. And please call and join the conversation. At one point you quote, I believe it's a quote from Phil, Christians are equally horrified to see their religion practiced or to see it doubted.
Yeah.
That just struck me. It's like, wow.
It's interesting. We had a book launch here in Lancaster this past Sunday, and I attend a parish here locally.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I wrote to the parish and asked if they would put notice of the Phil Berrigan book launch in the church bulletin. And they said no. And then we're having Father John Deere come to Lancaster next week, a Catholic priest who is also a peace activist. And I asked if they would put that in the bulletin. And they said no. So I don't know why the Catholic Church in particular seems terrified to talk about peace, but they are horrified to see it acted out in reality, to see the faith lived out in a day-to-day manner. It's one thing to talk about it on Sunday and to talk generally about peace and just to wish peace on the world, but to actually call it out specifically is something different. And Christians are good at condemning all war generally, but no war in particular. And I think they need to call out certain wars and actions in particular, and certainly recognize that America has a culture of militarism that's causing a great deal of death and suffering around the world. And as Christians, Phil and others saw that it was necessary for them to stop it if they were going to be true to their faith.
Well, you and I were having a discussion yesterday, and you said a couple of things that really struck me. And you'd ask me if I'd ever heard of the Berrigans in church or in my schooling in a Catholic school. And it was striking to talk with you to realize that neither one of us had ever heard the name ever uttered inside the institution. And then locally, I mean, with Father Jim Grappi doing civil rights in Milwaukee, you didn't hear. I mean, this was not going to be part of the education.
Not at all. I went to Catholic school here in Lancaster. I never heard of Thomas Merton. I never heard of Dorothy Day. I was never taught of Daniel and Philip Berrigan. It wasn't until years later that I heard of these people. And then I thought, oh, this makes sense. This is how faith works. This is how faith is put into practice. And I don't know why they don't teach that, because I really think they would get a much better response from the students. I assume it's because if they taught that, they might raise a generation of Catholics who would challenge the very comfortable position that the church has with the state right now. And they don't want that. But nevertheless, it's a shame. The Catholic faith is empty without action, without activities. It is meant to be lived out in this life as well as the next.
And it wasn't like the Berrigans weren't known. They were on the cover of Time magazine, which was a major weekly news magazine. And then you and I, I'm switching subjects a little bit, we're highlighting the fact that in Catholic churches, typically, you will see the U.S. flag up right next to the altar. You were able to get your church to put it in the back of the church, but it's still there. And it's kind of when people walk into churches and they're not familiar with this, it's pretty stunning.
It is. It's very jarring. And to see the flag up by the altar near the tabernacle in a Catholic church is really disturbing. It's inappropriate. It should not be anywhere in a church. It has no place there. The idea that the state, which is conducting wars of choice abroad and killing so many people, that would have a place inside a church, to me, is reprehensible. And so it's not just this idea of a separation of church and state, which pertains to a different concept. It's this idea of a separation of faith from allegiance to the state, particularly a warlike state such as we have. So I think that removing the flag is important. It's important to know that when you walk through those doors, you're entering holy space, and that you are to reflect on what you are literally being taught and how you are to act that out in your day-to-day life.
Thank you. Thank you, Brad. There's another quote by Phil. Let's build a real movement by building real people. Give each other hope and love. Let's push back the darkness.
Yes. Phil was big on that idea. He would repeatedly write about if you want to become fully human, and this was part of his journey to be more fully human, you're going to have to do the work of peacemaking. You're going to have to stand with the victims because that's the best work there is to do. And what it does is it connects you with everybody else in the world. You truly realize that you're connected as brothers and sisters across the globe. And whether you see that as part of Dr. King's beloved community or the Catholic Church's mystical body of Christ, everybody being connected, it's important to recognize that we are connected and we do need to work for each other, particularly those who are being oppressed or having violence inflicted upon them. And so, yeah, it makes you more fully human because if you think, what's the alternative? I talk to so many people who say the news is so bad, I have to tune it out. I have to turn. And I think, you know, you're tuning out part of your humanity. You're tuning out the greatest thing that you have, that thing that makes you human, your soul, your compassion, your empathy. So to tune it in is making you more fully human. It's completing your journey as a human being.
Thank you. That is really important. We are talking with Brad Wolfe, the writer of A Ministry of Risk, Writings on Peace and Nonviolence, the Writings of Philip Berrigan. And we're having a great conversation. You're welcome to join us. I want to switch gears just a little bit. Well, but before we go, are there other quotes from essays that just jump out at you that you'd like to share with us? And then I want to talk about how he made sandwiches.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there are wonderful essays. The Church in Chains is one of my favorite ones because he's writing a letter to Bishop Baum when he's in prison. And the bishop is a fairly good guy. I mean, he's the only bishop that came to see Phil when he was in prison. So that says something. And so Phil writes this letter, and he really lays out how we constitute the Church in Chains, meaning those of us in prison, those Christians who are in prison. This is the real church. This is the Church of Christ. And he lays out this really wonderful argument about that. And he asked the bishop, who was getting ready to travel to Rome for meetings with the Pope, to take this letter to Rome and try to, you know, give this to everybody there. So I think that's a wonderful passage. I think another passage that's really nice and shows a different side of Phil is, it's called A Tribute to Liz. And it's a tribute to his wife, Elizabeth McAllister. And he writes about that. And it's really a lovely passage. I found in an old out of print book. And I sent it to Phil's children when I was doing the research of this. And they were so appreciative. They had not seen it before. And it's really just a lovely tribute to his wife.
Could you quote from that? Could you read something from that?
Yeah, let me see if I can find that in here.
And then we should talk about Jonah House and the creation of
Jonah House. Absolutely. Jonah House was something that Phil created with Liz when he was released from prison in 1973. So Vietnam is coming to an end and they're trying to figure out how are they going to live and what are they going to do? And they decide to build this community house, sort of a Catholic worker type of house. And they get a property in Baltimore in a pretty dicey section of Baltimore. And they decide to have a family there and they have other people living there. And so there's anywhere from 15 to 30 people living at Jonah House at a time, all in community, all in faith, all in nonviolent resistance to war and militarism. And they purposely live below the poverty level so they don't have to pay any taxes for the wars and things like that. And they gather up food for everybody in the neighborhood to divide up the food. And they weekly, you know, have folks together and live in this wonderful community where one of them will decide, Phil will decide, it's time for me to do a nonviolent action and go to prison. And he would do that. He would be sent away for a little. And then when he would be released, Liz, his wife, would do an action and she would go away and Phil would raise the kids. And, you know, so they would go back and forth doing this. And I've talked to a lot of people who lived there over those years throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And it was this really fertile training ground for nonviolent activists. They would go there when they were young. They would be given these wonderful ideas and discussions, and they would be listened to. They felt heard very much by Phil and Liz. And then they went out into the world and they developed their own community. So it was sort of a seeding affair. You know, it was very nice.
And that still exists to this day.
It does. Jonah House still exists to this day. And I just got an email today about coming down to Jonah House and doing a reading down at Jonah House from the book and talking to the folks there. So it's still active. Liz does not live there anymore. None of the Berrigans are there anymore, but other families are there and doing community work. So it's still there.
That's great. Do you have a quote there, or should we?
I do. No, I have a quote here. This is a little thing. It's funny. I arrange these sections. So there's a tribute to Liz, which is immediately followed by a little passage that is called Liz in Prison, right?
Yeah, so I saw that, yes.
So it kind of gives you an idea of how their relationship works. But Phil writes about Liz, "I have never seen a person with less insulation between gospel and life. It almost seems that in her case, belief in the word attacks insulation, overwhelms it, throws it into retreat. That preserves her clarity, saves her from psychologizing, frees her for humor, movement, and life. So she works like a slave, but effortlessly. She is cheerful and in balance. She stays alive. She has no time for anything smacking of death, not complaining, indulgence, self-pity, negativity, or irritability. There is service to offer, resistance to be planned, peace to be made, life to live. So I revere her, love her, and remain in no little awe of her."
What a beautiful tribute.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks.
I read that to my wife, and she said, "Why don't you write those about me?"
Oh, that sounds great. Before we move into the more human aspects of Phil, I meet him in the 80s. There was a missile silo peace school organized by Nuke Watch, Sam Day, Cassandra Dixon, Bonnie Erfer, and others here in Madison, down in Missouri. And Phil Berrigan was there. He and I had lunch sitting at a picnic table. And for about 20 minutes or so, the two of us just had this conversation. And I was deeply, deeply impressed by him. And his opposition to nuclear weapons is deep and amazing. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, he began to see nuclear weapons as being something beyond just a weapon of war. It spoke to our intentions about humanity and how we felt about our fellow man and woman. The idea that we would build these weapons and threaten to use them, essentially threaten to incinerate half the world, that spoke to Phil in a deep and profound way. And he said it was making spiritual cadavers out of us, that we were growing numb to the idea of annihilating the world, that we would accept this and that we would pay for it with our own tax dollars, that the government would connive us into paying for our own destruction with our own tax dollars. So he pushed very hard about these baleful weapons, as he referred to them, because he felt we built our intentions into them and the mere possession of them was demonic. And on his deathbed in 2002, the last writing he has is that he says, "I die believing that nuclear weapons are the scourge of the earth and an offense against God." And he did believe that the possession of them, not the use, but the possession of them was an offense against God.
Yeah, at one point he talks about you don't make food without eating it. You don't buy a car without driving it.
Exactly, yeah. So there's an obvious intention there to use it. And what does that say about us? That if we do not get our way in this particular conflict, we'll incinerate the world.
That is deep.
Yeah.
Thank you, Brad, and thank you to Phil Berrigan. We are talking with Brad Wolf about Phil Berrigan and his recent book. And Brad is also involved in the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal. Can you talk about that, please?
Sure. I'm a coordinator along with Kathy Kelly and Nick Modern in a people's tribunal called the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal. And for those who don't know, a people's tribunal is a tribunal that is organized by the citizenry because the government will not act to hold people accountable for crimes war crimes, crimes against humanity. And this is a vehicle that's been used in the past. Bertrand Russell famously used it in the 1960s. He had a People's Tribunal where he held the American government accountable for war crimes in Vietnam. And so what we do is we've accused U.S. weapons manufacturers of needlessly fomenting war and producing products that they know are killing innocent civilians, and they're doing so for profit. So we felt this profit is driving war, and we want to shine a light on these weapons manufacturers, not necessarily the government, because we know they are complicit in what they're doing. But these folks, you know, Raytheon, Billing, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, they are making billions of dollars off of a lot of death and destruction. And these are U.S. tax dollars. So we wanted to shine a light on that and demonstrate that they're not passive players responding to contracts from the Pentagon, but that they intentionally create a narrative in the media and in the halls of Congress and in the executive branch that makes it sound as if the military solution is the only solution. And they're doing so for money. And they do this through think tanks and funding academic institutions and placing their representatives in the media in order to commentate on particular international crises. So over the last 2 years, we've been compiling evidence, video recorded evidence, where I've been interviewing witnesses. And these witnesses are folks like Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was the chief of staff to Colin Powell, Christian Sorensen, ex-veteran, and William Astori, ex-veteran, drone operators, victims of war, journalists like John Pilger and Matt Akins and Jeffrey Stern, people at Cornell West, to provide sort of a theological and moral component to it. And we've created these videos that we release every week that demonstrate the complicity of these weapons manufacturers and crimes against humanity. And if you go to merchantsofdeath.org, you can find all the information there. And we're coming up almost to the conclusion of the tribunal now. We will submit the final evidence to our judges at the end of May. And the judges are an international panel of judges from people all around the world. There are a dozen of them that we assembled. And they will render a verdict. And then we hope to carry that out. And a People's Tribunal is a great mechanism to get a lot of information communicated to people, because that's the goal, is to educate. And so we delivered subpoenas to these weapons manufacturers. We delivered contempt citations and all of these things to try to do what Phil Berrigan did, which was highlight what is happening. And kind of took the idea, because Phil Berrigan in the 1970s had talked about having a People's Tribunal and getting Henry Kissinger to testify about Vietnam, and got into a little trouble for that. And I thought, you know, it's time for a People's Tribunal about weapons manufacturers. So that was part of the inspiration.
Excuse me. So if people wanted to be part of that and see it, merchantsofdeath.org?
Exactly. Merchantsofdeath.org. Go there. All these videos are meant to be educational tools, so teachers can use them. Groups can, church groups, social groups, they can use them, have friends over, just watch them. They're maybe 20, 30 minutes long, and they're guaranteed to stimulate discussion. You watch it and just have a discussion afterwards. And the goal is, if we can educate and change minds and change hearts, then we can get people motivated to take action.
Wow. Thank you for talking about that.
Sure.
It sounds like you've organized that much like your book. Your book has very human-sized essays that I know you crafted in your editing. So it's very accessible and very inspiring, very, very thought-provoking, very profound. So
thank you.
I really appreciate that. And then you've got some stories of Phil as a human being,
yes,
making soup, making sandwiches for the kids' lunches. It's like, wow, there he is. Talk about Phil in the kitchen.
Sure. Phil in the kitchen is a great preface that Frida Berrigan, Phil's daughter, wrote for the book. And she has this reflection and memories of her dad. And, you know, Phil as a cook leaves a little to be desired. And I've talked to people who lived at Jonah House and talked about Phil's cooking. He either had no taste buds or he was entirely utilitarian about the way he used food. Essentially, whatever was left in the cupboard would get dumped into a pan, mixed together, and served up. And so it could be a combination of a can of pea soup with tomato soup. and some vegetables and whatever else he could find, mix it all together. Or it could be a sandwich of mayonnaise and cheese and peanut butter smushed together and served up. His pancakes on Sunday mornings were kind of famous because he would put everything into these pancakes. If there was grapefruit there, grapefruit went into the pancakes. Grapes themselves, grapes went into the pancakes, whatever it was. And people would just laugh and say they were awful. They were terrible. But for Phil, it was just sustenance. It was food. And you needed the sustenance and you needed the food in the same way you needed prayer. It gave you energy to go out and do the work that you had to do. So he wasn't one for frills.
When one of the kids got up early to make their own school lunch, just to avoid it, right?
Yeah, Kate would get up early to make her own lunch just to avoid Phil because he would pack lunches for the kids for school. And she was willing to be up a little earlier to make her own lunch so she didn't have to deal with that.
And Saturday mornings, they had chore time and then they collected flowers.
They would go around and collect flowers in a very interesting way. They would, for food, what they would do is, I guess what we would call dumpster diving today. I mean, they would go to grocery stores and get the leftover food that was being thrown out, and they would distribute it among everybody on the block, and then they would lay out everything they had found on their own table. And it might be a combination of artichokes and beets and potatoes and maybe some chicken, and they'd kind of think, okay, what do we do with this? You know, we've got to make food for 25 people. And then they would also try to get flowers, obviously, in order to bring back to the house. And Phil would take Frida when she was young, a little girl, and they would walk by homes or churches that had nice gardens. And Phil would give little Frida a pair of snippers to kind of step into the garden and snip a few nice flowers out while he kept watch and would stand there whistling, looking nonchalant. And she would go in and snip them out and come back, and they would have a nice bunch of flowers.
Oh, that's a great story. Oh, my gosh. So we've got a few minutes left. We're talking about Phil Berrigan's writings, A Ministry of Risk, a great book written and edited by Brad Wolf, who's our guest today. What is it that people really need to... I think you've said this in many ways, but I just want to make sure we don't miss anything. What is it that people need to take from Phil's life and Elizabeth McAllister?
Sure. We have these legendary peacemakers that we find it difficult to relate to. And so we tend to think, well, we really can't do much to push back the darkness because we're not like those people. But I think when you read this book about Phil and you read about things like the flowers and the food and, you know, the doldrums in the prison, you recognize that Phil is just like us and that every single one of us plays a part and that we all need to undertake some kind of ministry of risk to get out there and push back the darkness because the government is not going to do it. It is truly up to us. And if we're waiting for the government or we're waiting for somebody else to do it, it's not going to happen. And, you know, we are going to save ourselves and we all have talents. Some of us are good at organizing, mobilizing, others at public speaking, others at writing, whatever it is, discover your talent and put it to use for the victims. If you stand with the victims, you're never going to go wrong. You're always going to be on the side of right and you're going to feel good about the work that you're doing. And that's part of this process that you read about with Phil of becoming fully human. This wonderful journey he takes throughout his life from World War II soldier all the way to the end to becoming liberated. The three words I saw Phil use the most in his writings were revolution, resistance, and liberation. And I realized this is a journey that he was taking, that once you start nonviolent resistance, you inevitably recognize that revolution, nonviolent revolution, is going to be necessary to really cure all the ills of society. And once you embrace that and begin to live it out in your own life, you have liberation of a kind that you had never expected before. And I think Phil found that liberation in a way that not a lot of people do. He was truly a liberated and free man and yet had very little.
Well, and go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's it. That's it. I was.
Well, there's that great quote that we have a problem with surrender when they're convicted, but they forget to show up, or they don't forget, but they don't show up for their prison term. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, Phil had a great dry sense of humor. Another thing that makes him very humorous, you know, he liked a good drink and had a dry sense of humor. And so they were scheduled to begin their prison sentence. They were looking at the number of years in prison, 6 years for Phil. And on the day that they were to turn themselves in, after they had exhausted all their appeals, Phil and Dan decided that they were not going to turn themselves in, that they wanted to continue their resistance to the war by going underground, by becoming a fugitive from justice. And they weren't trying to escape a prison term because they knew that they were going to be arrested sooner or later. But they thought that they could do the movement, the resistance movement, more good by showing that these are the sacrifices that are necessary to bring peace. And so if you risk even more by becoming a fugitive and going underground and continuing the narrative, continuing to highlight things in a public way, you're going to do good. So they failed to show up when they were, and they immediately became part of J. Edgar Hoover's most wanted list. And they issued a statement that Phil simply said when they were asked, why did you not show up for your prison sentence? He said, we have trouble with surrender.
I love that line. That's a great line.
It's just a classic line, and it sums it up. And Phil was, he was a fugitive for about 2 weeks. He was eventually apprehended in a church in New York City. Dan went on a far longer sort of romp, eluding the FBI for about 4 months, popping up at churches and universities and radio stations across the country, giving speeches and then being whisked away just before the FBI agents could zoom in and get him, infuriating J. Edgar Hoover to no end. And he was eventually apprehended at the end of that year.
Yeah, that famous one where he's the big puppets.
Yes. And, at Cornell University, he was on stage in front of about 15,000 anti-war demonstrators. And I think there were probably 500 FBI agents in the audience.
Yep.
And in order for him to get away, they dressed him up in this enormous puppet costume. The puppet costumes were of the apostles. And so several of them on stage were dressed as apostles, and they put Dan in one. And the agents didn't know which one was Dan, and they were able to get him off stage and whisk away to yet another safe house. And again, infuriating J. Edgar Hoover.
And then J. Edgar Hoover ends up framing Phil Berrigan as if he's going to kidnap Henry Kissinger. And we've got a few minutes. Can you talk about the Harrisburg trial? And they end up being acquitted of this, but go ahead.
They do. Yeah, Phil's in prison. He's serving his sentence at this point, and he's in Lewisbury prison. And he and Elizabeth are exchanging letters, and they're talking about a number of ideas, you know, resistance effort. And the idea of a people's tribunal comes up, and Phil says, you know, Henry Kissinger might be somebody that we would have. And the idea is, well, he would probably have to appear against his will. And yeah. And so they abandoned that idea. And then they discussed other ideas, such as tampering with the steam pipes below government offices in order to disrupt business. But disregarded that idea as well. So they were just sort of talking through letters. But J. Edgar Hoover had an informant inside the prison who was copying all these letters. And he used those letters, just this conversation, to levy charges against Phil that would have put him away for life if convicted, and alleging that he was going to blow up government buildings and kidnap Henry Kissinger. And they went to trial on this. And jury selection for the trial lasted a month, just for jury selection. This was a very lengthy trial. It was in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. They put it in the most conservative town they could find in Pennsylvania, hoping the jury would throw the book at them. The jury eventually acquitted them. They were a hung jury. They couldn't come to a decision. And J. Edgar Hoover was so upset that he died of a stroke a very short time later.
I love that story of beating the FBI there.
Yes.
Brad Wolf, we are down to the last few seconds here. Brad Wolf is our guest today. He's written the book, A Ministry of Risk, Writings on Peace and Nonviolence, The Writings of Philip Berrigan. And I urge you to find that book and delve into it. Merchantsofdeath.org is another place to go. Brad, what's a final word from you?
Well, I'd encourage people to take a look at the book and read a story of a truly amazing individual and be inspired by it. Just sit back and enjoy it and then decide what you want to do with what you've read. And even read some of the sections out loud, because I was doing that when I was editing it. And when you have ownership of the words by reading them out loud, it affects you in a different way. So I would encourage folks, take a look at it, read it. It's a wonderful story of an individual and of our country at a critical time.
Brad, you are a joy to talk with and a gem, and we thank you for your gift of this book. I also want to say thanks to Jade, who makes all good things happen. Jay, who made the voices go out over the airwaves. Mary Jo out front, who makes the whole front of the WORT work. Brad, thanks again for being here. I look forward to meeting you in person someday.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Brad. And
take care.
We're on to the rest of the day at WORT. Enjoy your day, everybody. Thank you. Thanks, Brad.
Take care.
You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison.
Information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never be recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted.
Hello, this is Julie Candler with the BBC News. President Biden has said that the US will begin sending new military assistance to Ukraine within hours after he signed a long-awaited bill passed by Congress. Mr. Biden said the aid, worth $61 billion, would make America and the world safer. The package also includes billions of dollars in aid for Israel and Taiwan, as well as $1 billion in humanitarian assistance to Gaza. In his nightly video address, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said the support would help sustain his country's fight against Russia's invasion.
These days, we've been working as hard as possible with our American friends at all levels to quickly fill this package from the United States with exactly the kind of weapons that our soldiers need. I'm grateful to President Biden and Congress, to all Americans who feel the need to knock the ground out from under Putin's feet.
Israeli officials have confirmed they're moving ahead with plans for a military assault on Rafah in southern Gaza. They say several Hamas battalions are still in the overcrowded city.